Thank you, Donna. There is, again, the problem of having so many areas to chase in your questions. But if you get in quickly on that SMS number, they will come up here. I'll try to filter some. I've also got about 2 hours worth of my own. And when I go for a wander around with the microphone, I'm not just getting exercise. It means you can ask a question using the microphone, as old-fashioned as that may seem to you. Could I just start, though, by trying to tie together a bit of the trust story and the sharing economy story? That it makes sense to me that I would trust 30 strangers on TripAdvisor more than a corporate logo. What's the lesson there for the insurance industry in terms of becoming trusted?
Well, I think insurance has always had trust as a fundamental tenet of the relationship, that your customers trust the insurance company to pay out in the event of a defined event or whatever is covered by the policy. So there's actually been trust on both sides. The insurance company has trusted the customer. The customer's told that insurance company what they needed to know to take on the risk in the first place. And the customer's then trusted the insurance company to pay out in the event of a claim. So trust has always been a very basic fundamental tenet of insurance. I think what the shared economy is doing is keeping trust there, but it's changing the nature of it. So customers these days may not necessarily trust the insurer, because it's one of those big companies. Why would a customer trust an insurer when you turn on the news and there's always a bad story about insurance? There's rarely a good story about insurance.
Which is really the point I'm heading towards. I'm not sure that it was trust before. It was hope. It was a contractual sort of belief.
Yeah.
But you only find out, you only know if that trust is well placed when you have to make a claim. I had insurance for decades before I made a claim. How do we communicate a happy customer base to those who are yet to become customers?
Yeah, it's true that I think as an industry we've been very, well, I guess poor comes to mind in the way in which we have sung our own praises. You know, let's call it 99% of all claims are paid. It's only the one or two that don't get paid, and they're the ones that make the news. So I think we haven't been good as an industry at selling the good works that we do in the community.
I just want to throw a question or two at each of the speakers before I let you have your go, unless you hurry up and get texting or I get the microphone to you. Off the top, Fergus, talking about having a crisis response plan for cyber, is that any different, though, to having a crisis response plan for anything? And, you know, the most obvious example recently is the tragedy at Dreamworld, where you would say that company was not prepared for something that statistically was going to happen one day. Is there any difference really between being prepared for crisis in the real world, the cyber world?
Look, absolutely not. And I mean, it's one of the things that frustrates me is the fact that organisations that have very good crisis response plans in terms of, you know, physical assets being damaged, etc. So, you know, utilities, these kind of people, they don't necessarily have adequate cyber response plans. And I think that's because your traditional risk management teams, and I get to deal now with risk management people first and foremost, and then through the CIOs and the CSOs, they really don't communicate. You know, those kind of crisis response plans and then the cyber response plans. And often people are just like, I don't know anything about cyber. Too hard basket. You know, it's not actually that difficult. But once people in my industry start talking gobbledygook, everyone switches off.
I went to sleep there for at least 10. No, I didn't. I didn't. I stayed awake the whole time. All right, talking of gobbledygook, the nanoparticle, the unknown. How does an insurer insure something if you don't know whether it's good, bad or indifferent? I mean, that seems an impossibility to me. What magic do actuaries work?
It's a great question, Michael. And I mean, as I said during the presentation, insurers have been dealing with this sort of unknown for forever, you know. And unfortunately, usually when it comes to something like a new substance, and you could take asbestos, for example, usually only once claims start getting paid, you actually have an insight to the fact that this is a dangerous substance, or there's a dangerous particle. So the key there is to make sure that you stay at the cutting edge of knowledge, and that means you're having good conversations with people that are actually involved in the industry. You're having a lot of different touch points so you can stay at the cutting edge of knowledge on that. So then when you start seeing some trends coming through, then you need to quickly jump on it, because it's the people that stay at that forefront and ride the wave of exposure that we'll be able to deal with those things as they come out, and we'll be able to appropriately craft insurance coverage or exclusions.
So if I'm manufacturing toothpaste and it's chock full of nanos, are you going to insure me now?
Well, I mean, the reality is they are insured now because, you know, that the World Health Organization has said that nanotechnology is practically safe, or words to that effect. So the thing is, you, as a liability policy and a product liability policy, you're covering everything unless it's excluded. And at the moment, nanotechnology is not excluded because the current science, and the same with EMFs, with mobile phones, the current science is that it's safe, but there are indicators that it could have problems in the future. So it's very important that it's something that is closely monitored and watched and analysed on a dynamic basis to make sure that if you do see something come out, then you need to respond quickly.
Just wait till Senator Malcolm Roberts gets hold of the statement, though with mobile phones, well, maybe. Anything is possible. Donna, the question of the customer wants you to know about them. They want, you said the customer wants the insurance, his or her insurer to know about them. And certainly there are all sorts of ways you can know about them. When you ask the customer half the time, they carry on about privacy and pretend they don't want you to know about them. Is this bordering on the trust issue about how much the individual trusts the insurance company to use the data about them?
So I think there's a couple of things, and it does come back to the trust question, right? Because unfortunately, I think when you look at the list of most trusted professions, insurance is fair way down the list.
Well above journalists, though. Don't worry.
Sadly. there are two elements. So how do you find out what the customers want? You do go and ask them. And most people, when you ask them, not as they're buying an insurance policy, but you say we're doing an exercise, you actually go out and talk to people, meet them where they are. We do a lot of customer research where we just go and interview people and say, what do you think? You don't have to go out and say we're doing this for insurance. You just go genuinely, what do you think? What's important to you? And I think that's one way of bringing the customer into the frame, into the products and the services that we develop. The trust issue in terms of insurance, as Graeme said, 2% of claims are not paid, but they're the ones that are normally hitting the headlines. It's always the bad news story, never the good news story. Part of that trust comes down to the questions that we ask, the disclaimers we ask people to sign, the policy wordings that we put in place. So there is benefit in thinking about how we be a little bit more simple in our conversations and our wordings, and also just being transparent with customers. Like, you do have to earn trust. Amazingly, I think if you ask the 98% of the people who have had a claim and it went beautifully, they would trust their insurer to the end of the earth. But where some of our experiences, right? So you're influenced by everything that you are around us, so you can't take it for granted, and you have to continually be vigilant to saying what more, what more, what more. And the insurance industry has a job to do to actually say we add value, we're relevant, and we can actually help. If you think about the amount of money that insurance puts back into the economy, it's incredible, and we don't talk about the good news stories enough.
Actually, just turning the question around, what percentage of your customers do you trust?
So I have a claims background, and I also work for brokers. Percentage of customers, why wouldn't we trust them?
Because some of them are trying to rip you off.
Well, yeah, true, but I think from an insurer perspective, you have to start from the basis that we're selling, like the tenet of insurance is good faith, right? So you start from the basis that you're selling a policy in good faith and someone's making a claim in good faith. Technology, data is pretty amazing these days, and it can give you lead indicators where perhaps that good faith has been breached, but your starting point has to be good faith. Trust.
And then I could ask what percentage of the brokers do you trust, but I won't ask that question because what came to mind was, at the same time we've got lemonade as an example of, well, people are less likely to rip it off because there's some behavioural science behind it. Just looking and wondering at how you reverse the flow there. what the sharing economy can do more broadly. That question fell flat. It's over to you. This is your bloody industry. You're meant to know the right sort of question to ask. And no one's texting furiously, so this microphone will get to you. You only have to put up your hand or catch my eye. Or kick me, preferably put up your hand or catch my eye. What did these guys say that worried, scared or delighted you?
Hi, Amanda Aiken. I completely take your point that it's important to share good news stories as well as just to complain all the time. But I also think that it's important to share stories of failure and to be accepting of that failure. So I'm really interested, Donna, in some of the products that you're talking about trying. To what extent does the culture at IAG allow you to try something and then admit, OK, that didn't work, but be free to discuss that?
So the altruistic answer would be, of course, the culture lets you do that. Large-scale organisations, it comes back to how you set it up, right? If you set it up as an experiment, which the products I referred to have been, actually it's okay to fail because you will learn and adapt in a way. And I can think of an example where we've had a particular product out in the market for 3 years. I think the first year we sold 10 policies. We lost about $2 million. The second year we sold about 102 policies and we lost about $5 million. And we're just debating whether or not we should actually give it a run for a third year because the concept of the product is important, but we haven't quite got the selection impact, the right that sits underneath. I think when you're talking about let's try an experiment on a CTP product and let's just give it a crack, you probably want to have a little bit more governance and rigour around it. So I think it does work. To your point, though, about sharing failures, I think there's been a lot of press recently around some of the insurance industry's failings more broadly. When we think about some of the products where, again, the consumer's best interests have not been considered to be at heart. I also think of something like flood. It took the industry a long time to provide a flood product, but actually by listening to the consumers and the customers, actually we now have a solution that is much, much better than it was even 5 years ago.
And perhaps to your point, Donna and Graham, the thing is as well is that when it comes to consumer products, they're heavily linked with public policy. So if there's any shortcoming, perceived shortcoming by the insurance industry, therefore, the media would like to jump on that because it's a big story. And therefore, I think that when we talk about products and trying, the way the products are for customers and especially new generations of customers, then as you mentioned before, Donna, they're not looking for a product. They don't want a set and forget product. They actually want the ecosystem of, okay, insurance might be along at the end of coverage, but what's happening along the way? What are you doing for me as a business in my life, not just protecting me when something goes wrong? And I think as that sort of changes and as insurers start to change their and reinsurers backing that change their format and what they're looking to achieve, that will then start to roll as a better news story because it's actually providing a service as opposed to just a promise to cover something if things go wrong.
And that's a beautiful example, like when you actually, like, again, there is a lot of data that sits in insurance companies and also externally. If you can look at a small business that has particular risks and you notice something in your data that says they're not covered, you can create a relationship with the customer by saying, by the way, I noticed this. Actually, you might need to talk to an advisor or you might need to consider this sort of cover because you have a gap. That's the utopia, right?
To move it on a level from, it's not a matter of the 1% or 2% who have an unhappy claim experience. It's that whole pile of Australians who are underinsured. That says to me that, OK, we may not hate our insurers. We may trust our insurers, but we don't love them a lot. We don't sort of, you know, put them on our daily to-do list. How do you overcome that? Do you see any changes that could get through to that end of the problem? It's a constant, it's been there, we talk about it, but what happens?
It's one of those things that what do you get? You pay an amount, and if you don't make a claim, what are you actually getting for that? And I think that's why it's always been a begrudging purchase a lot of the time. You know you have to protect your house and your family and your contents and your possessions, but if I don't make a claim for a year, that money seems to have just disappeared, and if I saved it over 10 years, then maybe I would have had a better result. So the question is, what am I getting for it? And I think what our industry could do better is actually improving the risk at the front end better. You know, maybe to your point, Donna, you see trends and saying, look, in your particular industry, we're seeing sort of claims arising out of these sort of areas. What are you doing around risk management around that and actually being more caring about what the original insured is doing and what they're actually, how an insurance company can better their risk because they've got so much data?
Under insurance is a huge problem. Again, data can actually help save it, particularly businesses. If you go, people like you, you know, you pick your sum insured is $1 million for liability. People like you normally have $10 million or $20 million. Unfortunately, it's usually in times of extreme catastrophe that we see the underinsurance come to the fore. And then we see a surge and then we see it fall back. Yeah. So again, can we use data? Can we use, again, a broader education process about what's important to you? And again, start with the customer. What is important? Mm. Let's not talk about a conversation about what's your sum insured. Let's talk about what are the things that keep you awake at night and what do we need to protect and how much money would you need to do that?
That segues nicely to... here's a man after a microphone.
Yes. Thank you. The point you're making, the points you're all making is that you're talking about claims, you're talking about percentage of claims, you're talking about people paying claims. What I think the industry is about is actually peace of mind. So you're actually selling peace of mind, but up front you're not really defining for the consumer what peace of mind, how they're getting peace of mind. So I think you've got to reframe your product to actually say, now you can go on and get on with your life. Any reactions?
I think from a purely cyber standpoint, I mean, I mentioned that we'd acquired a company of some 650 consultants, and the whole reason for this is when I started, I had a look at some of the policies for the cyber policies, and I did this with an IT hat on, and I went, wow, that doesn't really cover me for anything. I ran some scenarios past and said, wow, it doesn't cover me for anything. It doesn't cover me for me making a mistake. Which is very common in IT terms. IT people tend to work quite hard. Technology moves very quickly. But I have seen in the last 6 months that, certainly on the cyber side of the market, that people have started listening to these actual scenarios and we're coming up with more effective policies that are effectively going to pay out when they have some of the problems. And the triggers that cause them are working. And I think this is just, it's a work in progress that's being undertaken at the moment. So, because we've listened. You know, the insurers have listened and come out with new policies and they've listened to the brokers and so, and the feedback we've been taking back is good. And I think that's positive steps forward, but still needs work.
That segues nicely. Oh. There's a fine line, isn't there, between selling fear and selling peace of mind. Mm. I often feel the fear. Anyway, that segues nicely to a question to Fergus. Does cyber risk suffer from the unknown unknowns? People don't realise they need it until it's too late. That not... They can't be sold peace of mind or fear because they just don't know about it.
Mm.
How big a role is that you come across?
All the time. She'll be right, mate. Haven't been hacked, not going to be hacked. It's very Australian, she'll be right, mate. Haven't been hacked yet. I get it all the time. And if you speak to our two global heads, so our global CISO, who's our internal CISO, he's from New York and he's got a way with words. He says... If you come across a risk person or a chief security officer who doesn't think they need to be at least looking at insurance, he says, better look for another job. It's his way of looking at it. The other one that comes up is our global head, Kevin Kalinich, cyber risk. When people say to him that they don't have a problem or they don't think they're going to have a problem, he does the slow clap. So you're better than the FBI, you're better than the NSA, you're better than Google, you're better than Apple, who all had hacks. So admittedly, we're having to start to resort to those kind of tactics to get people to wake up and smell the coffee because, again, as I said, less than 2% of businesses in the country have it.
To Nick, if you had to punt on what would be the big risk that everyone is talking about in 5 years, what would it be?
Well, to steal Fergus's thunder, it'll probably be cyber risk. But if it's if you're talking about emerging risks other than that, probably the biggest one is the road to autonomous cars. I think the fully autonomous cars is quite a ways off, but the driver-assisted cars and the use of telematics, and as you mentioned, Graeme, is already changing behaviours now. It's already having people drive better. It's actually improving risk. So I think that's not really an emerging risk. It's just an emerging technology that's changing the way in which people are behaving and that's having a flow-on impact to insurance. I hope it's not nanotechnology because it is so widespread and if something like that kicks off, it could be very large. And I would say at the moment, in the next 5 years, in the short-term future, would be drone technology. Just the numbers are staggering over the next 5 years as to how many drones are going to be in the air. In the US alone, there will probably be about 8 million drones in the air in the next 3 to 5 years. And when you take into account, that's probably only about 15%. Commercial aircraft, only about 15% of that. There's a lot more drones in the air. So I think that's one of the things that will have such a large impact on insurance and the reinsurance industry.
See, I'd be disappointed if I came away from this conference without being scared of something else. One more question from here, and then I'll get the microphone down to you. Graham, if the sharing economy is only forecast to be a few percent of the market by 2025, does that mean that for most consumers, price is still more important than trust?
Well, I think trust has always been important. I think it always will be. That's how people have choose their insurance company. That trust is replicated in terms of reputation. So insureds choose an insurer based on the reputation of that insurer that they will pay out. So I think trust will always be the fundament. It's got to be there. People choose an insurance company assuming that trust is there on price because it's one easy way of making a decision. They assume the product is pretty well the same from one company to another. The difference as they perceive it might be price. So they choose price. I think price has been very important, and back in the olden days when I worked in your company, we used to say that price was 80% of the decision, and it probably still is 80% of the decision. So it will be important. So trust, absolutely fundamental. Price, very, very important.
From the floor.
Hi, I'm Sharanja Padam from Deloitte. Look, I was really taken by Donna's comment about, the insurance in the future is going to be the rise of the customer in a different way than we've had in the past. And also just taking on the theme of trust and what might be different. And, it's really interesting about how you sell insurance or how are you meeting customers in that place? And a lot of things happen that are quite interesting that, if when I talk to boards and say, we have an issue with how insurance is perceived, the response is some variation of, but we're the good guys, we're here to help people. And that seems to have been what we've been doing for years after years and after years. But there is strong evidence that that message is not getting through, particularly amongst millennials, particularly amongst different groups. Insurers aren't trusted. And it's also to do with a whole bunch of other trends. And I'm wondering, is it time to change our story, time to stop scaring people about how bad their risk is and all the rest, and start to talk about a different way of selling insurance? Maybe one thing we could talk about is insurance being an enabler, insurance allowing to do things that otherwise we could not do. We can't have cars on the road at the moment if we didn't have CDP insurance just because of the number of people who would be injured without protection. Travel insurance is an enabler. Millennials buy travel insurance. I mean, that's one of the interesting products that they do like and they do buy. We talk about people being able to have their laptops and their phones and the products that they do buy are those. So I'm wondering whether it's time to move away from this kind of meme or kind of idea that this insurance is this stale, old, secure, granddad that's going to protect you from the bad evil in the world and you just have to pay him a little bit, to actually insurance is exciting. It enables you to jump off cliffs and go bungee jumping and, start a new business and all those kinds of interesting things.
You're calling Graham granddad? Is that what you were doing there?
As a matter of fact. I think there's a lot in that, and I think one of the responses we're seeing in the community now amongst the digital natives is the great interest in social insurance, the peer-to-peer insurance, as they call it overseas, more of mutuality of insurance, how one customer can impact on another one by terms of sharing their risk. So there is a movement. In Australia, it's pretty small. In fact, globally, it's pretty small. It might be a start of a trend over the next 10 or 20 years. I guess we'll find out in 10 or 20 years' time. I'm a bit of a sceptic, but I'm old.
I just might want to add something in there. So, when I started, I saw that in the cyber risk, a lot of the cyber presentations that you see, and sorry, I focus on cyber because it's all I do, but cyber presentations, a lot of them focus on fear. It's not if you're going to be hacked, it's when you're going to be hacked and all of this kind of stuff. And I looked through our collateral and I just kind of went, nah, this is not good. Exactly to your point. So we had a cyber risk symposium recently. The catch line of that was secure your success. We've also got heavily involved with a few of the startup incubator type organisations where we're talking to fintech startups and technology startups and this kind of stuff. And we're talking about how a platform for enablement and a platform collaboration should include some sort of risk transfer solution so you can grow your business, so you can do this and that. We've definitely changed our messaging on this, and I think we're becoming very much, much, much more positive. And that's because I think we need to, because the IT industry has been driven by fear for so long. That's exactly where it's at. So I completely agree with your point, and we're definitely trying. But as you saw, even from my presentation, I still had to put something scary up there.
Yeah.
I think insurance will be less about transferring risk and more about servicing the customer needs. So if the car is pranged, you know, help me get my car fixed rather than just help me pay for it.
Hello, Andrea Führer from Suncorp New Zealand. I'm wondering if the insurance industry has been changing quite dramatically in general. We're talking about trust and peer-to-peer insurance, and we are really good at getting better at assessing risk. And if I think it is from a customer point of view, I don't want to be in a bunch of people that are bad risks. So I want to be with the good risks and pay little money for it because I consider myself a good risk, for example. So what happens to all the people that are actually not good risks? Because insurance used to be, well, we pool a lot of people together and everyone chips in, and then we can afford to pay for some people, and lots of people never ever claim. But now everyone wants something special, and it's customized, and I totally understand it, but I'm not sure how this is going to work, because that is not what insurance used to be about, and I don't know if people are willing to pay what that might cost. I mean, it's nice to think that I might get a mobile phone insurance that is just for the weekend because I go skiing, I might lose it, but I don't want to pay a horrendous amount of money, and if people claim for every time they go, then how can we afford a product like that, for example?
I think one of the perfect cases of showing that is telematics. So there was an interesting statistic a while ago that 90% of drivers think they're better than the average, and so they think that these drivers think that they're actually funding other drivers when they're a lot lower down the bell curve. So what telematics has shown is, and this is the whole thing about changing behaviour, rather than saying I'm a good or a bad risk or I'm subsidising, it's finding out that within the pool, where do you sit as your behaviour, and then insurance and telematics as an example, changing that behaviour. So you actually become a better risk, so it actually betters the pool in general. So that's one of the examples, and I think we might see more of that as technology can be utilised to actually help people become better risks.
No one else wants to buy into that. The core of it, though, if you can get down to the pool of one, you do wipe out the bad risks. You're not allowed to do it with general medical insurance.
So I think it comes back to, like, everyone's got access to data, right, and you can price to a pool of one. So, you know, there's been a bit of conversation about what is the value of insurance, how do you trust, how do you actually... So why do people want to insure? It's talked a lot about a grudge purchase. When you talk to people, it's not necessarily a grudge purchase. It's, I think one of the people said before, it's actually about how to give me peace of mind. I want to actually still be able to keep going if my house burns down or I get robbed or my business is actually impacted by an event that's beyond my control or my supply chain doesn't work. So insurers are working pretty hard at what's the proposition that sits around how do you create value. So yes, you might be able to create to price to a pool of one. What's the value of that? And if you're a great risk, that's sensational. We would love to have you on board. But there is also a piece that sits around it to say, well, actually, what can insurers also open up in a world that's much more connected? So some of the work that, again, we've been thinking about is how do we create hubs for some of our customers. So if you're insured with one of our brands, can you actually get access to cheaper cars or something? So is there a proposition beyond insurance where people go, you know, I can see value in that?
Yeah.
And again, like there's a lot of work that's been done, not only in the organisation I work for, but also across the industry about How do you think about beyond having a product to how do you think about a proposition?
Yeah. This question has come through, which is really across the day, that a major theme of presentations throughout the day has been about technology, the disruption caused by technology. Do you think actuaries as a profession are doing enough to keep up with the new technology and the opportunities it creates? Is the industry making as much use of the opportunities as you do talking about the disruptions? Don't all speak at once. Take your turn.
I was going to say I can only speak for the insurance industry as a whole, but I think the whole part of the conversation that we're actually a slow-moving industry. You know, we're by a lot of measures we're still a traditional industry, and things move fairly slowly, and there's still companies that use, you know, tables and rates and things like that as opposed to using technology. So I think as an industry, the question always comes up, are we utilising technology to drive the industry, or are we driving technology to the better of the industry? And I'd say it's probably the former, is we're trying to catch up with the wave of technology. So insofar as whether the actuarial segment is keeping up with technology and utilising it, I can't say, but I think the insurance industry as a whole could do a lot better, and there's a lot of work around that. A lot of companies like IAG, for example, have their digital lab, so a lot of work is around technology, about trying to stay ahead of, or at least on top of the curve for the betterment of the industry.
Which segues into another question. What would the panel advise to actuaries to get involved in this future, this brave new world? How can actuaries break out of the tables and the rates and those sorts of things to get ahead of what is measured?
So I think it comes back to the basic things like curiosity, like thinking about what might be rather than what has been, and actually being curious enough to actually think about things in a different frame. I think the ability to connect data to deal with the constraints. Yes, our industry has a lot of system constraints and technology constraints and trying to marry data up, but it can be done. So how do you think about what's possible? And also not strive for perfection on the first go, like continually adapt and adjust as you go rather than try and be everything to everyone.
Graham?
Oh, I'm just thinking how I can add to that. Actuaries can't be everything to insurance companies. And we've talked a lot about technology, but technology will only be good if it can be accepted by the community. And by the community within the insurance company, I'm thinking about the culture. So the insurance company's got to have the culture to accept and exploit the technology. I'm not too sure what role actuaries have in that. There's a limit, I think, to how much actuaries can get involved in the overall journey. They're certainly part of it, but there's a limit to it. And I think culture is a bit of a sleeper. That culture will stop the success of a lot of technology if it can. So how an insurance company can bolt on the technology and have a culture that can accept and exploit that technology is really, really important.
You know, we've talked a lot about behaviour economics and how those two things can mesh together, and we've also considered, you know, around underwriting bias and things like that. So there's a lot of bias in the way we traditionally look at things. So I would say be open-minded to what's coming in the future. Think about different ways. Think about whether there is a bias that you've got inbuilt about something. I think that's a question we all need to ask ourselves, because as more information becomes up to date, then you can actually analyse that and look and say, have I in the past looked at things a certain way because of my experiences, and do I need to look in the future? And Donna mentioned earlier that the past is not a good reflection of what's going to happen in the future, so think about that as a part of it.
We are, we are just on time. I've got time for one last question. It was one that occurred to me when Fergus was first started speaking, and that is, look, if the poles and wires in New South Wales were owned by a Chinese or a Hong Kong company, would they be any more prone to hacking than any other company?
Well, then they're already hacked, to be honest with you. I don't think it would make them any worse or any less. I mean, there's been quite a few cases. There was a case of Huawei, which is a Chinese manufacturer of infrastructure, and it turned out that the Chinese government had implemented some backdoors in there. So, I mean, it can happen. America's as bad as it, as anyone, in terms of in the interests of, you know, national defense, et cetera, and anti-terror. So, look, anything that's connected to anything, regardless of who owns it, can be hacked. I suggest that, you know, like I say with people who are, who are outsourcing, you know, they're going for in the cloud type services, and they ask about whether things are more secure or less secure and this kind of stuff. And it's how long is a piece of string? My answer on all of those cases is read the contracts. You know, in that particular case, we look at the laws and how they're supported in and around how that stuff is maintained and administered and looked after. And service levels, contracts, again, you know, like we all don't look at our, no one reads the acceptable usage agreement on their Apple iPhone. No one reads it. So, and I've come across a lot of people who've signed up, you know, outsourced stuff to third parties, without looking into the terms and conditions and what their responsibilities are under that. So, no more likely or less likely, I guess.
Fergus, have you read the terms and conditions of your Apple iPhone contract?
Absolutely not.
He had me worried for a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time for this plenary. There are so many big issues there. I think we've touched on some of the challenges still, rather than the solutions, because obviously if you solve them, they wouldn't be interesting anymore. Just on that autonomous vehicle thing, if you Google autonomous vehicles and jobs loss, you will get estimates of somewhere between 4 million and 7 million jobs that would be lost if autonomous vehicles reach their potential in the US. All those truck drivers and Uber drivers and taxi drivers. A wave of technological change, we didn't even get into what happens when artificial intelligence wipes out so many transactional people in your industry. An example given at a conference in Brisbane last week was that something like, it was either 14 or 40 librarians at one of the universities had lost their job because they weren't needed thanks to IBM's Watson. So the reasons to be scared continue to multiply, but so do the opportunities. Could you please thank our wonderful panel of Fergus, Nick, Graham and Donna.